What I'd give to hear those three little words. Man, that's such a wonderful phrase. To hear those three.
Maybe we should retire that as an introduction to Patricia T. O'Connor, because it really made sense with her first three books, Woe Is I, Words Fail Me and You Send Me. But the fourth book was Origins of the Species, four words, and there's no song that says four little words.
Well, I'd like to stick with three. If we elide the of the, we could make it Origins do Species, do Species.
Yeah, the French would have done it.
Yeah, right.
Usually English sentences are briefer than mm-hmm. Spanish and French sentences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's because they insist on having all of those articles. But in this case, the do really is much more efficient.
Yeah.
You wanted to talk today about a German word.
Yes, I wanted to talk about one of my favorite words and one of my favorite emotions. Schadenfreude.
Why is that a favorite emotion, Pat? Well, you seem like such a nice person.
But underneath, I'm secretly taking delight at other people's misfortunes. But didn't you feel a little bit of Schadenfreude, for instance, when 2 feet of snow got dumped on Washington and not on New York?
Well, I was just pleased. I had been to Washington the week earlier, and uh-huh. I was very pleased that
well,
I wasn't.
See?
But that's
there.
Not Schadenfreude. That's simply I escaped. Otherwise, it would have been very difficult getting to the National Gallery.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, we can thank the Germans for this word, of course. Schaden, meaning misfortune or adversity, and Freude for joy or pleasure.
The Germans do a lot of compound words.
Yes.
And they often work well in English as well.
Uh-huh.
Weltanschauung,
right,
one.
Uh-huh. Bildungsroman. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing it correctly. But yeah, they get to
it's
string
so good. This is New
they
York
get to
public,
string
New York public
together.
Radio, not Berlin public radio.
Right. And they get to make big long words. Getting back to Schadenfreude.
Yeah.
A reader,
you really want to get back to Schadenfreude?
Actually, a listener of WNYC, a fan of yours named Leonard from Manhattan, has written in to say that he thinks there should be a parallel word for just the, not the opposite, I guess, but the inverse feeling, which would be pain at another's good fortune. And we've all felt that too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whenever the MacArthur Fellowships are announced every year, there's all kinds of inverse Schadenfreude. But at any rate, as it happens, there's no word in German. But over the years, a lot of language junkies have tried to come up with such a word. And the easiest thing would be just to reverse Schadenfreude and get Freudenschade. Well, that doesn't exist in German, and I have a feeling that it might have humorous connotations, because in German, Freudenhaus, literally joy house, is a brothel.
Mm.
A Freudenmädchen is a prostitute.
Now you're getting into politics.
Right. And I think somehow if you had a compound that meant joy, pain,
uh-huh.
You might be in...
right, the dominatrix stuff.
Right, different kind of territory, the Mädchens yeah. with the boots and the whips. But at any rate, a lot of people have come up with things for joy, pain at another's joy. And one possibility, another pseudo-German word, would be Glückschmerz, which would be luck pain. Pain at someone else's luck.
But isn't envy simply the word?
Well, yeah,
that applies
it could
to that?
Be. It could be envy, but I think Glückschmerz, if it existed, would be a little more powerful. You
I'll
can
try
envy someone
that.
Without feeling bad about it, you know. But at any rate, I wanted to share with you some of the other compounds that people have come up with over the years, related compounds, Schadenfreude.
Schadenfreude. That's joy at somebody's iPod?
Yes, exactly. That's taking delight in your iPod. Blondenfreude.
Mm.
That's glee felt when a rich and powerful blonde gets her comeuppance. And, Palenfreude, glee at the stumbles of a politician, and Spitzenfreude, right, at Eliot Spitzer's misfortunes, and Frankenfreude, which is probably what Al Franken's opponents felt early on in his early election setbacks, but later that would have been changed to either Frankenschade or maybe Frankenschmerz. But at any rate, that's it for the German today. But
I have a different thing. Before we take calls, by the way, our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. I've been hearing regularly on news reports and elsewhere a sentence like, the snowstorm has led to a number of highway closures. And I always thought closure meant bringing to an end, to a conclusion.
Right. Uh-huh.
I also, if I remember correctly, remember that it was a mathematical word.
Mm-hmm.
But highway closings, isn't it? When
I know.
Did closing become closure?
I know. I think somehow closure sounds a bit more authoritative or more of a news event than a closing. But I get people ask me that sometimes. Why do people talk about school closures?
Yeah, school closures.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that
always
would be
final. With the snow, suddenly everything is a closure.
Right. Right. I have a variation on that highway thing, though. I was once listening to the highway, the chopper, whatever report that tells you what's going on the roads. And the announcer said that a particular highway had been coned off. It's coned off.
But I know what that means. That's rather poetic, don't you think?
Yeah, it is. And it sounds like maybe the highway was not too happy about it.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah.
Well, I don't think we should discourage that, although I think that there's a difference in saying that sort of thing in conversation or in a talk show and saying it on a news broadcast where clarity is really
the
most important
thing. Now, coned off is perfectly clear because it's obvious that's going to be really temporary. But a closing or a closure could mean they've cut it off for some construction project for weeks and weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of like coned off.
My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, and we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. We also invite your comments on our show page at WNYC.org. And you invite people to write into you. You have your web address, mailbox, what is it? Grammophobia?
Yeah, go to grammophobia.com and you'll find me, and there's a thing to click on to write me.
Now, I say this every time, but I'm stunned at how many times I get emails from people saying, I wrote to Pat O'Connor at mailbox at grammophobia.com and bounced back. And they misspelled the word grammar.
Yeah, or sometimes their emails block responses. I get blocked.
But I'm talking about misspelling the word grammar.
Well,
I would have
true.
Thought that people who would write to you would know how to spell the word. It is a complicated word.
We think we've taken care of that. I think we've arranged to have the ER spelling send people to the right place.
But then you're going to get Kelsey Grammer's email.
Ooh, that would be fun. Oh, I wanted to mention one more thing since you talked about announcers. The Olympics have been going on. People may have noticed a couple of verbs sneaking in. To medal, M-E-D-A-L, to medal. And actually, that one has made it into dictionaries. This is not the first year for that. But a more recent one, to podium. Have you heard to podium? Stand on that three-level platform.
Now, that reminds me of another mistake that almost everyone makes, that they say he was standing at the podium. No, you were standing at the lectern.
Right, right. You stand on the podium.
Now, why do you think that's happened?
I don't know, but dictionaries are starting to treat them interchangeably, so before long that won't be a mistake anymore. This is what happens. Words mean what people think they mean, and if enough people think they mean the wrong thing, pretty soon that becomes the right thing.
A listener, Brian from Bushwick, wants to know if you know the etymology of the cobble words like cobbler and cobblestone. Adding to that, you know, a cobbler who works on shoes, but then you also have a peach cobbler. Maybe it's cobbling things together, putting things together.
You know, I don't know. I would think so because
cobblestones are like mosaics.
That. Yeah, we use cobble to mean putting things together, to cobble together a solution to something. Here we get, let's see, cobbler. From the Middle English, cobbler. Okay, one who, archaic, it meant one who is clumsy at work, a bungler, but it also means one who mends or makes boots and shoes. Doesn't exactly give the etymology of it.
Oh, too bad, because I was trying to understand Cobble Hill in Brooklyn, which for years I thought was a kind of like New York, it would be like New Kabul from Afghanistan. But right. It turns out it's not Cobble Hill.
Too bad.
That would
maybe
be
it just once had cobblestones on it, or they got cobblestones from that spot or something.
My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, and we're taking your calls here at WNYC at 212-433-9692. Theo, you say Theo from Austria, or at least originally?
From Austria, yes, from Vienna.
Have you experienced Schadenfreude?
Yes. You know, Schadenfreude is, it's not very noble to be filled with Schadenfreude. So your guest may not say that in Germany or Austria.
Oh,
well, it's not considered
Schadenfreude for other people.
Theo, it's not considered noble in this country either. But if you're honest, you have to admit that you've had that feeling more than once.
Yeah, better him than me.
All the time. But, you know, not to be the recipient of it. But anyway, I was actually had a question and a comment. And my comment was that I am from Austria, as we know. And I'm a songwriter here. I'm Theo Eastwind. Check me out, TheoEastwind.com. And I've been writing, I have 5 albums. And, you know, it's been quite a struggle, actually, of switching over from German to writing in English. And because I remember when I was in Austria and I wrote poetry, I would just feel it and just to write the words as they come in a poetic fashion, and it would be just beautiful German, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in English, I really had to learn to switch over to really know what it is that I'm trying to say.
In other words, you can't do stream of consciousness in English.
Right. I cannot just go and fall into this poetic, sort of dream state where I just, go and write the words down as they come to me, as I feel them, as I did in German. In English, I don't have that, same connection. So I had to switch over and really, really think about what it is I'm trying to say. My question was, do you know of any German or Austrian or Swiss immigrant who actually became successful switching over from writing from German? And I came in, I was 20.
One comes to mind immediately, Billy Wilder, who not only...
Who is it? I didn't hear you.
His name is Billy Wilder, one of the great American filmmakers.
Oh, Billy Wilder, yes.
And he not only made great... There were other Germans who made great movies in Hollywood, but Billy Wilder made great American movies. In fact, he made Ball of Fire, which he wrote Ball of Fire... or co-wrote it, which is all about professors learning how to speak American slang. So he fell madly in love with American English.
Mm-hmm. Has he written poetry as well?
I doubt it. But Vladimir Nabokov, who's Russian,
poetry as it were.
That would be harder. I think that Bob Dylan sometimes sounds like he's translating from the German. So maybe
he was born in
Newt Gingrich too.
I'm talking about who has successfully transitioned from being a German poet into writing English poetry.
Well, not German, but what about Conrad? Polish, correct?
Yes, although he didn't write poetry. He wrote great prose, which has a poetic side.
Yeah.
He became one of the greatest English stylists. Now Nabokov, whose languages were English, French, German, and Russian. His English is some of the most beautiful in the language, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. It's I don't know. I think I wonder, though, if Nabokov and Conrad and even Billy Wilder had those stream of consciousness moments in English, or if they had those in their native languages.
I think that they both fell in love with English, and so, and there probably are others whose names are not coming to mind right now,
yeah,
who fell madly in love with English. I'm sure, in fact, any of the writers who like Conrad, and so they wind up writing more beautiful English than most native-born speakers.
Right. Maybe because they're more careful or precise about it. But, you know, I just got an email yesterday from a WNYC listener who said, you know, you really should watch Ball of Fire and pay attention to the first 15 minutes. Listen really closely. So I added that to my list of must-see movies.
It's a wonderful
film. It's funny
film.
It should come up again.
Well, actually, I saw it. I saw that email, and I saw it when it was on Turner Classic Movies just the other day. I watched it again, even though I've seen it a million times before, because it features such wonderful performances by Gary Cooper and especially Barbara Stanwyck, who is just marvelous.
Yeah.
I love Barbara Stanwyck.
Yeah, I do too.
Let's take another call.
Okay.
And this is from Ben from Rockland County. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm thrilled. Leonard, I'm a big fan. My question is, when we say, this is a little bit off your topic, when we say in here in the United States, someone is passing the buck, or when Harry Truman had that on his desk, the buck stops here.
I think those are two different things.
Okay.
Well, I don't know.
What are they?
Well, if I remember correctly, well, passing the buck had to do with something with playing cards or something where you had a horn?
I don't know.
Well, we can always look it up, or somebody can call us. But the buck stops here simply means that,
didn't it mean he wasn't going to pass it on to someone else?
Yeah, responsibility winds up here. So money can move, but eventually it stops somewhere, and somebody has to take responsibility for it. And Harry Truman, unlike some presidents, was willing to take that responsibility. Sometimes he probably should have tried to pass the buck, but that's a whole other matter.
Yeah.
But we invite you. You know, one of the things that's so great about this show is we have a really smart audience, don't you think?
I think so. I think they're a lot smarter than I am.
Well, I wasn't going to say that, Pat.
Well,
but we invite listeners to call us and tell us if anybody's out there right now. I guess we don't have Google available to us, but
and I don't have my OED with me to check out the etymology of Kabul.
Or passing the buck.
Or passing the buck. But I'm sure people out there will be emailing it in.
And we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we will find out what people have come up with and also take calls on different aspects of the language. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. We're back with Patricia T. O'Connor, author of Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, Woe Is I Junior, Origin of the Specious. Any other books in the works?
Gone with the Wind.
Really?
No, not at the moment.
Well, and we are taking your calls. There was a joke there, but I was going to let it go. I think I'm going to let it go. Our number here is 212-433-9692. Anne in North Bergen says her favorite German compound word is Schlimmbesserung, and it means an improvement that makes things worse.
Oh, that's a wonderful word. We've got a word like that, haven't we?
Do we?
You know, it's nagging at the back of my mind, but I can't think what it is. I think we have a similar word.
In English?
Yeah.
That is means an improvement that makes things worse.
Yes. Oh, well, I'll think of it later.
Isn't that the way it always is? Sabrina from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm going to buy a dictionary, and I don't know how to choose one. But what are some of the factors or criteria that I should be looking for. How do I know which one is the best?
Well, I have two standard dictionaries that I use the most, and they're very different. One is the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language, 4th edition. The other is Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, 11th edition. And they're both very good, but they are on different ends of the spectrum as far as prescriptive versus descriptive. American Heritage is more conservative. It's a little less likely to include variant pronunciations or meanings that it thinks should be standard. Merriam-Webster is likely to have more of these things recognized.
They're permissive.
As standard. They're more permissive, yes. And see what else? They both have usage notes that are handy. American Heritage's usage notes are a little bit longer. American Heritage has a lot of nice little color pictures in the margins. I think Merriam-Webster's has black and white drawings, if I'm not mistaken. But it matters, I guess, mainly for the purpose you're using it for.
Just your ordinary...
Either of those would be great.
I think either one would be fine. You might go to a bookstore and page through each one, look up a favorite word, look up hopefully,
right,
and see what they say.
And hopefully that'll help me. what advantage do you see to American Heritage? I understand the conservative permissive, but why would you want two? Why do you?
I like to have different points of view. Actually, I have more dictionaries than that at home.
Oh.
Those are just the two standard ones that I use most, and I depend mostly on the OED.
Okay.
Now, there are a lot of dictionaries will give you all sorts of word usage suggestions. Mm-hmm. I don't even remember the one that I have near my desk, but I opened it up today because I was looking up closure to make sure that I was right about that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, under close proximity, and the dictionary said, it is not worth quibbling over the redundant aspect of the phrase, although many people get upset. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, now that's what I mean by a usage note. They will tell you things like that. Or they might tell you that some people don't like the use of this as an adverb, but it's becoming more... prevalent, so it's quickly becoming standard.
So what's happened with hopefully?
I think that it should be recognized as a legitimate sentence adverb. In other words, an adverb that can modify a whole sentence instead of a single verb within the sentence. Like, hopefully he died a satisfied man. Now, you don't mean that he died hopefully, that he was hopeful about dying. You mean that you hope he died a satisfied man.
I have a speech impediment. I still can't use the word, although I don't mind that other people do.
I don't use it that much because I don't really have use for it that much. But I think that it should be
You're not that
okay.
hopeful. Joan in Garrison says, since the presidential election, I hear the phrase going forward no less than two or three times per day on radio and television. Do you think it'll go away or is it here to stay?
I think it'll go backward. I don't know whether it's here to stay. I think it's already becoming so tired sounding that I think that maybe speechwriters will stop using it just because it doesn't sound fresh anymore. Sometimes these phrases slip into usage because they have a freshness about them and doesn't sound like the same old usage everyone else has. But then when everyone else starts using it, it loses its freshness and it withers away. So, you know, we can't decide these things. We just have to wait and see what happens.
Let's take a call from Manhattan. Laura, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I have two concerns, but I'm not sure if I can bring up two things, but I'll start with the one that's...
Well, maybe you can conflate them.
Okay. First of all is the question of the plural of email.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to say, for instance, I received lots of express mail today, that would be fine.
Right.
If I were to say I received lots of emails today, to me that would be incorrect. because I can't get my mind around turning male into a noun which takes an S.
Well, the difference is that male, just plain male, is a collective noun. You don't get a single male. You might get a piece of mail that is in your mailbox. But there is a noun, an email.
Yes.
There, an individual email is called an email.
I just simply write email messages. Is that wrong?
That would solve it right there. Email messages.
I don't see that there's a problem with saying emails, however.
Really?
Well,
you wrote "you send me,"
which was all about the language of the internet, didn't you?
Yes.
Although it keeps on changing.
Yeah.
And there's a language of the computer. Years ago, we talked about whether the plural of mouse, the computer mouse, mm-hmm. was mouses or mice.
Uh-huh.
And computer people were saying at that time, I don't know if it's changed, that it had to be mouses.
Well, some people some computer people say mice. But interestingly, the use of the mouse is getting less and less as more and more people use laptops. So that's... Who knows? The mouse may go the way of the telephone receiver. So I don't know. But I really do think that mail and email are two separate words, and you shouldn't judge one of them linguistically by the standards of another, because you can't have a mail, but you can have an email. And if you can have one email, you can have two emails.
Hmm. I'm so confused. When does it become men? A listener writes in about passing the buck, and he says the buck indicates a current dealer in card playing. And I seem to remember, I was fumbling around about this, that there were people who played cards with a buckhorn, and you would pass the horn over to the next person, the dealer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you came to pass the buck. Maybe I'm wrong, but...
I'll have to check it out when I get home.
A listener wants to know if saying I'm good is okay when people say, how are you?
Yes. I know I'm going to get a lot of angry mail about this, but I see nothing wrong with saying I'm good.
I always took it as almost like making a value judgment about
mm-hmm.
yourself.
Well, no. You mean that I'm a good person?
Yeah.
No. The verb to be is a linking verb, and you modify linking verbs with adjectives, not adverbs. You can say I'm well if you want to, but it has a different meaning from I'm good.
Now, a listener in Hell's Kitchen says that closure has meant closing for centuries. Her old OED gives examples going back to 1600. But I think that we're talking about a different kind of closing. I looked it up in the dictionary, and it definitely did not sound like you can do a highway closure.
So you
unless
think
you were closing it forever,
closing.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
But
well,
I don't know.
Again, if people use the word closure to mean a temporary closing, whether it's acceptable now or not, it's soon going to be. So all we can do is use the language that we like to use and come to accept what the rest of the population uses.
Fran from Manhattan, how you're on the air.
I'm curious about the recent prevalence of using myself as opposed to me. The comment was directed to myself as opposed
mm-hmm.
to me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true that it's blossomed recently? And is it?
There are objections to that that get raised. It sort of comes in waves. Every couple of years, people will start to complain about hearing myself everywhere instead of me. I think that myself is useful to a lot of people who can't figure out the difference between I and me. Most of the time, it's unnecessary. People somehow don't like to say me. I don't know if they think it's an ego thing or what is it. So there's nothing wrong with saying me.
But
it's a perfectly good word.
It's saying they gave it to myself or...
No, that's
it's so often used.
Yeah.
Sounds wrong, but used.
I always advise people that if you can use I or me instead, you probably should.
Just.
But is there a reason for it recently, just being, or am I imagining that people are using it many, many more times?
You may be imagining it. Maybe you noticed it, and once you noticed it, you started seeing it everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, of course, there's that song, Me, Myself, and I.
Right.
We all agree.
Right.
But I don't know if you've noticed, but spell check will question the use of self as part of a compound word, even when the alternative is stupid.
You know, I always tell people that they really should disable the grammar checker on their computers. It's that bad. I really think it's harmful. I would leave spell check in because it's always worthwhile to stop and look another time at a word, and it also will prevent you from repeating words like the. But the grammar advice is absurd. It's really crazy that any sentence that starts with the word what has to have a question mark at the end. Silly. Again, there are legitimate uses for myself when you're referring back to a subject already named, or for emphasis, or that sort of thing. But if you can use I or me instead, I think that's a better choice.
Let's go to Marie from Brooklyn. Hi, Marie. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yes. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to mention that just the past week, I've heard two educated and professional women use the word innovate in the sense of trying to energize.
That's a new one.
Yeah, they were both medical people,
and
said they learned it while learning their practitioner. Well, one's an acupuncturist and the other one is a masseuse.
Well, you know, medical people are the only ones who use the verb present as an intransitive verb. So you have to take their grammar with a bit of salt.
But innovate is one of those words that...
Innovate?
Enervate.
Enervate.
As opposed to energize.
Yes,
enervate is the opposite of
energize. It means to drain of energy.
But it sort of has a sound that it might mean energy.
Right,
Providing energy.
It's like disinterested.
Right.
It sounds like it's uninterested, but it means something else. And I think all of those words are going to lose their meaning, don't you?
Yeah, they have. Disinterested already has, I believe. And at one time, it meant the opposite of what it does now anyway.
Mm.
Disinterested and uninterested over the centuries have played musical chairs.
Hasn't Folsom also gone through that change?
I think so.
And now it's going back to its original meaning, even though many years it meant something negative. Now it means something positive again.
Yes.
So I'm just going to have to adjust.
And update that dictionary.
I tend to be a perfectionist about language, which is not a very good idea.
Thank you. We have very little time. We want to sneak one more caller in. Dana from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I work in the medical field. I'm a doctor, and I often have to... I interview patients, adult patients, like in their 60s and 70s, about their children. And I've never found a word that I can use besides something really technical sounding like offspring or something like that to refer to them without thinking of them as, you know, a child.
That's an interesting... what about just son or daughter? I guess you need a neutral one.
What about your produce?
Yeah.
Your spawn!
We got to leave it there, unfortunately. We'll come up with something somewhere down the line. By the way, if you want to get in touch with Pat, you can go to her website at gramophobia.com, actually mailbox at gramophobia.com, if you want to actually say something to her. We will be seeing you again on March 17th. And meanwhile, people can check out all of your books, right?
Yes.
And they are Woe Is I Junior, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, and Origins of the Specious.
Yep.
Thank you so much for being with us. And thank you, all of you who called in.